This is an ABC podcast.
This is the WA Country Hour on ABC Radio WA.
And hello there, Jessica Hayes with you on the Country Hour this afternoon in the chair for Belinda Varaschetti again today, broadcasting to you live from Bunbury in the southwest. And today you'll hear more on that soil announcement from this week's federal budget, in particular a pilot program that would see you, the farmer, get paid to share your soil data. Is that something that you would be willing to do? Or would you be apprehensive to share that kind of information? You'll also hear today on the program about a move by a beef-loving US state to ban plant-based products from using meat labelling. So words such as chicken, pork and beef. And later in the program, after the news and weather, you'll hear why genetically modified corn has been used as a tool to battle fall armyworm. That's the invasive pest that's causing some pretty huge problems across Australia. So is GM corn being considered here in Australia? Send me a text this afternoon if you want to have your say. The number is 0448 922 604. I'd love to hear your thoughts. Up first today, though, research into Australia's soil has happened for decades. So why is the government offering a rebate to test yours? Treasurer Josh Frydenberg this week announced the government will be spending $200 million over 4 years to buy existing private soil data. Neil Menzies is the Dean of Agriculture at the University of Queensland. He is also a fellow of the Australian Society of Soil Science. He says there's an emerging carbon sequestration market, so it's imperative to improve our overall understanding of soils.
It's a document that helps us to understand what the challenges for Australia's soils are. Our soils are, by nature, ancient and infertile and really quite sensitive to the impacts of land use, farming, etc. And so we need to be quite careful and quite deliberate in how we manage our soils. And the strategy lays out some of those issues, you know, tells us about how Australia's soils have been damaged in the past and how we might manage them into the future to make them better than they currently are, but also so that we can gain all of the advantages that we might get out of soils.
So the funding that was allocated last night, was that for the initial phase or phase two of the strategy?
There are some key things in there. There's a substantial investment in soil testing, so soil sampling and testing. And I think this is really critically important because it'll give us a snapshot of what condition our soils are in across the country and help to build up more information about the condition of our soils so that as we go through time, as we resample, we'll be able to see whether we are improving our soils or indeed running them down if we aren't successful in managing them. There's an investment over a longer period, 4 years, in implementing what's called National Soils Science Challenge. And so this is an investment to increase our understanding of the science. Let me just give you an example of why this is really important. One of the things that we hope we can achieve by managing our soils better is sequestering carbon in the soil. So literally taking carbon dioxide out of the atmosphere by growing plants and then having a lot of that carbon preserved, held in the soil through time as soil organic matter. And this has two wonderful advantages. One is that it reduces atmospheric carbon dioxide, so reduces the risk of global warming, but it also has the advantage of increasing the fertility of our soils. So if we can achieve this, there's two really great benefits out of it. There's an investment in extension to farmers, so to articulate to farmers ways that they can manage their soils better, and I'd calibrate that by saying Australian farmers are already extraordinarily good at managing soil. So it's not as though we have a low starting point here. But as we develop new technologies, we need ways of getting that out to the farmers. And so that's what that investment would be about. And then there is a smaller investment to really coordinate the various things that are in the National Soil Strategy. So there is already investment in soil science by state governments around the country and by universities. So this is to ensure that we are working together optimally rather than, you know, many of us doing the same thing and other bits remaining neglected. Coordination of activities through the country will be really useful. And finally, in the budget, there's an investment in over a period of 10 years. So this is a recognition that this is something that will take a long time. Development of very low cost ways of measuring how much carbon is in the soil. And so, Megan, this ties back to the question of can we sequester carbon in soil? And then if we work out ways to do that, to actually monitor through time how much we've sequestered, which, of course, is important for our national carbon accounting so that we can say, you know, we're burning this much coal and oil, we're using this much energy to heat our houses or whatever, but on the other side, we're sequestering this much carbon in our soils and offsetting, hopefully, quite a deal of what we have to put out in the way that we live. So as you can probably tell by my tone here, it's really a very exciting announcement.
Speaking a bit more about the sequestering carbon in soil, so that would really open opportunities for landowners for more opportunities for carbon farming in different ways.
Absolutely. You're right on the money, and really this one is about money. If we can find ways of sequestering carbon in soils that are economically attractive to farmers, so in other words, the cost of them changing their practice so that carbon is sequestered in soil is more than offset by the value of that carbon that they've sequestered, then it becomes another type of business for them. You know, if we're talking about a wheat farmer on the Darling Downs of Queensland or in central Queensland, they would continue to grow wheat as their main piece of business, but they would grow it in a way that resulted in the carbon in their soil increasing through time. So that would be an additional income stream for that producer. And as I stressed earlier, this has this wonderful benefit of not only sequestering the carbon out of the atmosphere, which we all want to happen, but it actually improves our soil so that the next generation of farmers and the generation of that after that come into a farming enterprise that is better than their father or their grandfather had. So you know, a generational benefit here, both in climate terms, but also in the quality of the soil and the quality ability of our agricultural systems to be productive.
University of Queensland's Dean of Agriculture, Neil Menzies, with Megan Hughes. So as you heard there's a suite of programs in that National Soil Strategy, but one of the interesting ones is that payment to farmers for sharing or collecting soil data. Bunteen farmer Stuart McAlpine has been focused on the health of his soils, particularly the biology of the soil, for many, many years now. He says it's great to see soil health on the national agenda, and he'd be happy to share his soil data.
This is a great initiative. I think one of the criticisms I've often had in the past is science doesn't always get out into the farming situation often enough, and I think that there are some wonderful land managers out there that have been doing some really innovative things, but they probably haven't been captured well scientifically. So I think if we can marry some of the innovation that's out there in the industry and try and get a better handle scientifically on how that fluxes with environmental conditions and the seasons, then I think by sharing knowledge, I think we can grow a lot faster as an industry. So I think that's very exciting.
And what is the value of like a big picture map of soil data?
Yeah, that's a really good question. And I think as farmers, we tend to farm in isolation, and the catchments, we all know about our catchments and river systems and stuff like that. But we've probably moved away from those catchment approaches from the 90s and 80s when there was a bit more funding. So I think we need to recognise that our farms are part of an ecosystem. And I think if we can have a more comprehensive look at how they might interlink, and I notice there's some stuff on biodiversity as well, then perhaps we can actually, get some win-win where we can actually change maybe the use of some of the land and give it a better use for biodiversity or other, farming systems that might be more suited and give it more resilience.
It's not in that budget rundown, but Neil Menzies from the Australian Society of Soil Science at the University of Queensland has said one of the projects expected to be funded as part of the strategy, and there's a grant program element, is low-cost ways of measuring carbon in soil, basically to bring down the barrier for farmers to participate in carbon offset programs. How would that benefit West Australian farmers?
Immensely. I think one of the greatest impediments so far is actually the cost of setting the benchmarks for the methodology that's been established so far. West Australian farmers have very large tracts of land, so to measure it is extremely expensive. So if we can come out with faster and quicker ways, and I think, tools that actually constantly measure carbon are coming. I mean, I've been speaking to people of late that are talking about, new technologies that are coming that are able to measure in just about in real time. So I think that's really exciting because I've noticed, on my farm that carbon levels in the soil do flux with the different types of seasons that we have.
Is it an area that you've played in, carbon trading?
No, it's not. And one of the reasons is that we've probably only just recently had the methodologies for us as Australian farmers. The upfront cost is quite considerable. And, there are some schemes out there, but, I'm not always keen to give away all my carbon credits to a third party either. I'd like to keep control of them. So in the meantime, I've just understood that building carbon in my soil is important because it, increases water holding capacity, nutrient holding capacity, filters the water and all the wonderful things that we know about, and have just got on with it. And I think one of the sad things, is the early people that have concentrated on building soil carbon are probably not going to benefit from their good stewardship because most of the programs only will start from where it's measured. And that's a bit of a shame.
Bunting farmer Stuart McAlpine speaking with Lucinda Jose. What's your take on that pilot program which would see farmers paid to share soil data? Are you already collecting that kind of information at your place, and would you be happy to sell your data? Feel free to join the conversation on the WA Country Hour this afternoon. You can flick me through a text on 0448 922604. And we have had a text in from Rob at Metricup. He says, "Hi, Jessica." It actually says Belinda, but I'll save you on that one, Rob. He says, "I would share my soil sample data, no problems at all. Great idea. More knowledge of our soils is a really good thing, and surely there is nothing to hide." If you'd like to have your say, again, that number this afternoon, 0448 922604. Now, Keith Perkin is the Chief Executive of Perth Natural Resource Management, and he's not quite as pleased as Bunting farmer Stuart McAlpine. In fact, he's a bit underwhelmed. And while he's happy with the strategy broadly, he says an investment of $197 million is just not enough money.
Well, I'll start with it. It is a good strategy and something that all Australians should support. And I say all Australians because if we want to remain food secure in the long term, then we really need to invest in this key asset. And this key asset, as we know, is under a lot of pressure from things like wind erosion, soil acidity, salinity and climate change, while at the same time we are asking a lot more of it to feed a growing population. So when I look at the budget allocation for this strategy, which is $197 million, I do think it's actually somewhat underwhelming. To give a little bit of perspective on that, and I did a bit of maths on this last night. In Australia, we have around 420 million hectares of agricultural land. So if you look at $200 million investment into that, it equates to around 50 cents per hectare per year. And really, it's just not enough for such an important asset that's under pressure.
What would be a more reasonable figure for you?
you could put 10 times the amount into it. I would say $5 a hectare. If we are serious about looking after the land for future prosperity, I'd put another zero onto it.
One of the things highlighted in the federal government's budget papers is the aim of increasing farm gate output to $100 billion by 2030. Is that achievable?
I don't think it is, no. We've been hovering around $60 billion a year for quite some time, and we know that since the 1990s, productivity increases have been sort of plateauing, and that's mainly due to drought and flood, and in our case in WA, that persistent decline in rainfall. I feel that it's actually working against actually achieving good outcomes in the strategy because, you know, to go from 60 to 100 billion in, what, the next 8 or 9 years would pretty much say your assets stripping the land for the export market. And it's just not good. We need that land to be in good condition for the future.
There are a few elements in the National Soil Strategy of just shy of $200 million. One of them of direct benefit to farmers is the National Soil Monitoring and Incentives Pilot Program. So that's got a couple of elements, including paying farmers to share their existing soil data and also incentives for farmers and land managers to do soil testing and then share it. What's the benefit of widespread soil data in one place, Keith?
Well, soil testing is a key component of understanding or measuring and then managing your land or the soil in the land. And having an understanding of where that's trending is crucial to how we move forward and then linking that back to the farming practice and the impact that farming practice has on that soil. So it is very beneficial to do and supporting farmers to do that. More importantly, if it's done independently, so advice given back is independent, that would be a huge step forward.
If you could write your own personal federal budget, Keith, what would be the number one thing that you would put money into?
Identifying those practices for farmers that can help restore natural capital. I do believe our innovative farmers are best placed to identify and share those practices that can viably restore natural capital. And we should probably pivot investment around supporting those farmers to do just that. So I would put farmers first as the ones that are best placed to find the solutions to all this. We tend to have this, we can call it arrogance in some ways, to think that the academics and the scientists and everyone have all the solutions. But I do believe farmers have solutions and probably the most appropriate solutions and, yeah, support them first.
Yeah, they've got the skin in the game.
They have, absolutely. And we all have because we all want to eat food. So farmers are just on the front line, really, and they have answers. They have solutions. I would actually pivot a lot of money towards supporting them to identify and share those solutions.
Skin in the game indeed. Perth Natural Resource Management Chief Executive Keith Perkin with Lucinda Jose. 22 past 2.
You're listening to the WA Country Hour on ABC Radio WA.
Jessica Hayes with you on the WA Country Hour this afternoon, filling in for Belinda Varaschetti. And it's so good to have you along this afternoon. And coming up after the news, headlines and weather, we're talking all things corn, in particular the question of whether genetically modified crops could be used to manage fall armyworm. And it's that pest that just seems to be popping up all over Australia. But before then, all eyes in the Australian meat and meat alternative industries are on the beef-loving US state of Texas this week. And that's because lawmakers have passed a bill that would ban plant-based products from using the terms meat, beef, chicken, pork, and even burgers. The House of Representatives voted in favour of the bill on Monday, and it'll go to the state Senate before becoming law. John Daly reports.
Lawmakers in the US state that's really synonymous with steak and cattle production have moved to ban the use of the words meat, beef, chicken, pork and even burgers from plant-based, lab-grown or insect-based food products. The bill has passed through the Texas House of Representatives on Monday and will now be voted on by the Senate before it becomes law. The same debate on labelling is still going on in Australia, and meat industry advocates like Margot Andre from Australian Pork Limited say Texas could set a precedent that Australia could follow.
Well, absolutely. I've been watching. The US has actually been very proactive on dealing with this issue, and they've been dealing with it for a number of years. And I know Texas has been keen to try and find a way to actually make sure that there is truth in labelling. So it's wonderful to see this progress. And at the same time here in Australia, we're actually starting processes to push for the same thing here.
And does this Texas bill, does this set, if it does get turned into law, do you think this will set a precedent for other jurisdictions like Australia to look to these similar rules?
We certainly hope so. And as I said, we've been watching the US for about a decade now as they've pushed through on this. But we have been hoping that, you know, these companies would step up. But the reality is if they keep using the terminology that makes people confused, we're going to have to go down this path and follow. But yeah, great for Texas to be doing it. They're certainly leading the way.
Plant-based products make up maybe 1% of the market, very small percent of the market. So in trying to get, you know, get these rules put on this industry, is the meat industry being a bit precious, do you think?
So I think the bottom line is that there's always going to be a requirement for an alternative protein. But I think the reality is that whilst it is only a small sector, it is a growing sector. And whilst pork, for example, is growing at an incredible rate, which is fantastic to see, these sectors are just in their fledgling starting stages. So it's about, I guess, helping them get these processes right. Not being precious, I think it's more about, it's about fairness. Just do the right thing at the beginning, and then the consumer will decide the growth trajectory of those products. So that's what we're asking for.
In the state, the bill is being supported by the local cattle industry and opposed by plant-based food companies. Submissions from firms like Impossible Foods claim it would impair its First Amendment right to free speech and restrict the ability to accurately describe its product in a way consumers understand. Thomas King is CEO of the alternative proteins think tank Food Frontier, and he says there's no evidence that plant-based meat alternatives mislead consumers in the US or Australia.
Firstly, I think we need to be careful not to overstate the significance of this bill, which hasn't actually passed into law yet. This is one state in a country of 50, and we've seen similar laws like these, even once passed, get banned or otherwise halted in California, Arkansas, Mississippi, with federal judges halting them as for being unconstitutional censorship based on First Amendment rights. And so the reason that we've seen legislation like this fail time and time again, not only in America but other parts of the world as well, is that in most instances there isn't substantive evidence to support the claims being made by proponents of this legislative change, predominantly being that consumers are misled.
Do you think that there will be a time when some kind of bill or some kind of proposal is put to the Parliament for similar kind of laws? And I guess, how do you rate the chances of success?
So the most recent evolution of this discussion was a working group established by the Minister for Agriculture with representatives across agriculture and the food sector. And that concluded in March of this year, finding that there was no evidence of significant consumer confusion around the labelling of plant-based products. And as part of that process, the plant-based sector actually offered to develop voluntary guidelines for the labelling of products within this category, which would draw upon existing elements of the Food Standards Code and Australian consumer law. My concern is that if we get bogged down in these sorts of conversations about things like nomenclature, it actually distracts us from the bigger conversation we should be having, which is the economic and agricultural opportunities that new protein sectors present for Australia. Now, we have thousands of farmers in this country producing protein-rich crops, most of which go to the global commodity market and don't command a premium, whereas by investing in the facilities to process and value-add those crops into the kinds of ingredients needed for products like plant-based meat alternatives, we're actually generating more value at the farm gate.
Thomas King, CEO of the alternative proteins think tank Food Frontier, ending that report from John Daly. What do you think about that one? Should we follow Texas' lead here in Australia and ban plant-based companies from using the terms meat, beef, chicken, pork on their products? Love to hear your thoughts this afternoon. Feel free to send me a text on 0448 922 604. It is 29 past 6, which means it's time to get an update from the newsroom. I'm joined by Jonathan Hopper this afternoon. Jonathan, what's making news this afternoon?
Good afternoon, Jessica. WA's Health Minister Roger Cook says the death of a 7-year-old girl at Perth Children's Hospital last month has had a significant impact on staff. Mr Cook yesterday apologised to Ashwarya Ashworth's family for a system that let them down after a report into the girl's death was released. He's told Parliament hospital staff are heartbroken and it's important to ensure Ashwarya's death is not in vain. The Australian government says it will provide more help to Fiji as COVID-19 numbers rise in the small Pacific Island country. Authorities there have ordered two major cities, including the capital Suva, into a hard lockdown from tomorrow night. Case numbers within the community have been steadily rising after a hotel quarantine breach last month. And the AFL has invited 4 more clubs to bid for a spot in the Women's League from as early as 2022. Hawthorn, Essendon, Sydney and Port Adelaide have a chance to prove their readiness to enter the competition. AFL CEO Gillon McLachlan denied the speed of the AFLW's expansion will deplete the talent pool and standard of the game. Thanks, Jess.
So much for that update from the newsroom, Jonathan Hopper. And shortly you're going to be getting some corn. You'll hear how the US used GM corn to fight the fall armyworm and how the current high corn prices, they're really high, are posing a big problem for Indonesian feedlotters. And then you'll hear from Rabobank grains analyst Cheryl Kalish-Gordon, because I want to know if those high corn prices means there might be some opportunities for you, WA's and WA's grain farmers. But it's time to head to the Bureau now, where I'm joined by duty forecaster Noel Pusey to get a wrap of what we can expect over the next few days. Noel, what's happening across the Southwest Land Division?
Yeah, at the moment, Jess, we've got a high-pressure ridge starting to develop south of the state, high moving into the Bight overnight into tomorrow and also through Saturday and Sunday. That's a dominant feature for the next few days. Generally, easterly winds over much of the state. In the south, some isolated shower activity today along the south coast and the Eucla coast, but it won't penetrate very far inland. And similar sort of conditions for Friday as well. Some morning showers possible along that south coast, Eucla coast. And we'll see a little bit of shower activity develop perhaps Saturday afternoon through western parts of the southwest district and adjacent areas there. Just a little bit of convective activity through there, so some light falls possible over that area, but only very light. Otherwise, the whole state, including the southern half, generally easterly winds, fresh at times, particularly over the Pilbara coast and the West Kimberley coast for the mornings on both Friday and Saturday, and some strong winds also possible in the morning in the far north Kimberley coast for Sunday morning as that high pressure ridge sort of progresses slowly east over southeastern Australia. But generally dry for the next few days. At the main area of any shower activity, as I said, might be Saturday afternoon through the southwest Capes area and adjacent areas. But during Sunday and then pretty much during Monday and into Tuesday, we have a very slow-moving feature moving in from the west. So we'll see some light shower activity continuing through Sunday in the southwest district, and perhaps the far western Great Southern, but only light falls. The main front associated with that, with fairly fresh northerly winds ahead of it, will come through Monday evening into Tuesday morning. So some moderate falls expected through that at the moment, and some mainly in western and southern parts of the southwest land division, but it isn't impossible that the even eastern parts might pick up a few millimetres out of it too. But that's the next sort of significant rainfall on the horizon. And until then, really generally fine conditions. Easterly winds turning around to the northeast and then the north over the weekend into the early part of next week.
And what are the northern and eastern forecast districts looking like now?
Yeah, pretty much the same through there. The ridge is developing strongly and it's affecting the north and east, and the northern half can easterly winds, gusty at times along the west Kimberley and the Pilbara coast for the next 2 days, and we'll see clear conditions through there and quite dry as well.
And what are we looking at in the way of warnings this afternoon, Noel?
No warnings are current for the state.
Thank you for that update this afternoon, Noel. Bomb duty forecaster Noel Pusey there. And for the latest rainfall totals from the last 24 hours, I'm joined now by Richard Hudson. Richard, is there much to report?
No, there isn't a huge amount of rainfall around, as you're probably aware. I mean, in the northern and eastern forecast districts, nothing at all. And then in the southwest land division forecast districts, in the central west, a few places had 2 and 3 mils, but then out of the blue, Canna East got 33. Canna's just due east of Geraldton by a bit over 100 kilometres. And I'm hoping that it's not one of those anomalies where someone's had the sprinklers on or something like that. I did chat to a farmer at Mingenew today. He said he got a little bit, but unfortunately there's a howling easterly and 28 degrees, which is drying everything out. So he's still got a little bit of moisture in the ground. He's planted his lupins and canola and they're coming up quite well, and he's just putting the wheat in now. But, yeah, if you're around Canna and you got some rain, if you can validate that fall of 33 mils, that'd be nice. I think it certainly was needed in that area. They haven't quite had as much as other parts of the grain-growing regions. In the lower west, nothing above 3 mils at Minston Park. And then in the southwest, a few places had 1 to 2 mils, but the top was Nanup with 3. Then in the southern coastal region, lots of 1s and 2s, but nothing above that. In the central wheat belt, nothing above 2. In the great southern region, same sort of thing. Actually, mostly just dew there. So, yeah, Canna East is sort of right out there.
Absolutely. I think I saw on Twitter a little map showing it. It was quite remarkable. Thanks so much for that update, Richard Hudson. It's 24 minutes to 1. Now, over the last year, you'll have heard a bit about the fall armyworm pest. It's that tiny, hungry caterpillar moth that's now eating its way around Australia, and it seems to like corn in particular. Now, the question being asked is, could genetically modified crops be used to manage fall armyworm? Well, Megan Hughes has the story.
Fall armyworm has now infiltrated 6 states and territories. This week, Tasmania was added to the list. It's become so hard to control, whisperings have started about a method that's been off the table for almost 2 decades, genetically modified corn.
Anecdotally, I am hearing from the field that some farmers are saying we need GM to help us control the insect. It's a major discussion point for the industry as a whole, because for the last 3 decades, we as an industry, as the Maize Association, have been working uniformly to say that we do not need GM in Australia.
Maize Association of Australia President Stephen Wilson. So how have GMOs been used to control the pest in other countries? And could it work here? Fall armyworm is native to the United States and has devastated many crops there. But corn in the States is genetically modified. It produces insecticidal proteins that naturally occur in a bacteria found in soil and is known as BT corn. North Carolina State University professor and extension specialist Dr. Dominic Reisig said, while BT corn doesn't specifically treat fall armyworm, it's helped.
It was first commercially planted in 1996, but that particular BT corn that was planted did not control fall armyworm. And so it wasn't until different BT toxins were introduced that we really started to see fall armyworm control. But because it's a sporadic kind of outbreak pest throughout the U.S., it wasn't like a huge earth-shattering moment when we were able to control fall armyworm.
Would you say that treating fall armyworm is a multi-pronged approach? It would require GM crops as well as using commercial insecticides?
Yeah, I guess I would have to answer that question specific to the crop. So in maize, fall armyworm infests both the whorl, and when I say the whorl, that's when the plant's in the vegetative stage. You know, it's typically, you know, somewhere between your knees to your waist high. It's not formed in ear. And once that fall armyworm gets down in the whorl, it's very difficult to control. But the good thing is when it attacks corn at those stages, it's not particularly limiting to yield. So the corn looks really bad, but it generally pops out of it and it's not a problem. If fall armyworm attacks later in the season, say when maize has an ear, then it's a problem, because once it gets inside that ear, you can't control it. And then it's a really damaging pest in terms of yield. And it's really difficult to control with insecticides. So, yeah, you know, BT is the way to go. In other crops where it's not so protected, you know, things like soybeans or maybe some vegetable crops or things like that, it's pretty easy to control with foliar insecticides.
Currently, Australia only grows three GM crops, cotton, safflower and canola. Corn has remained GM-free, allowing the industry to access GM-free markets like Japan and Korea. Maize Association of Australia President Stephen Wilson says adding GM to the mix here risks losing those markets.
Well, it would impact on any export market that's happening now or potentially in the future, and also on all the domestic markets, everything from dairy cows utilising the maize as grain or silage, right through to beef cattle and right through to human consumption. So it is a major, major, major impact that would need to be agreed to by all sectors of the industry.
Mr. Wilson said even trialling a GM crop would be complicated.
Well, you'd have all the regulatory issues of actually bringing the germplasm into the country. You'd have the quarantine issues of having the facilities that can handle the GM product. Then you've got the issues of field testing. So it would be a long, drawn-out process, and we would have to consider the impact on the industry as a whole, because it's very hard, if not impossible, to have part GM, part non-GM. It is done that way in the US, but it is a very expensive process that makes the non-GM corn, being in the minority, makes it a very expensive product.
A spokesperson from the Federal Department of Agriculture in a statement said genetically modified maize seeds may only be imported into Australia under an import permit issued by the department, but said no applications had been made.
Megan Hughes with that report looking at whether GM crops could be a tool to manage the growing fall armyworm pest problem here in Australia. Now, corn is eaten fresh by humans, but it's also a really important feedstock for animals. Indonesia's feedlot industry is really struggling at the moment, partly because corn is so expensive. And as Dan Fitzgerald explains, this was one of the main talking points at a recent discussion between Indonesian and Australian cattle industry heavyweights.
The Indonesia-Australia Red Meat Partnership brought together industry and government leaders for an online discussion about the state of the live cattle trade between the two countries. The Indonesian government's representative talked about how it wanted to reduce beef prices in the country. In response, an audience member suggested reducing the price of corn could help feedlotters get more kilos on cattle cheaper. But the challenge at the moment is that global corn prices are the most expensive they've been since 2014. And what appears to be exacerbating the problem in Indonesia is that the government's Bureau of Logistics, known as Bulog, is the country's only corn importer, which often sees the price increased further. Feedlotter Dicky Adewoso said it's an issue for a lot of agricultural industries in Indonesia.
Yes, it's not only us. I think our fellow from the poultry farmers also complaining about this, but I think there need to be some improvement restructuring in the licensing of importation of those items that we want to import. We are still lobbying to get much easier. At the moment, I think the corn are also only being imported by Bulog at the moment. So I think that's what we have. We're trying to get over it. If we can import directly. I'm speaking on behalf of the whole industry, not only my company.
Consolidated Pastoral Company, or CPC, alongside Running Cattle in Australia, operates two feedlots in Indonesia. Its CEO, Troy Setter, said cheaper corn prices would help drive down beef prices in the country.
If we could get world parity in corn price in Indonesia, we would feed a lot more corn to our cattle and we would have a cheaper production. So be very happy to have world corn price policy in Indonesia, and that would help with the efficiency of the cattle trade in Indonesia. But it would also reduce the cost and price of chicken, and I think we need to be mindful of that, that if we have cheaper grain for cattle, we'll have cheaper grain for chicken.
In response, the Indonesian Deputy Minister for Food and Agriculture, Musdalifah Muchmud, speaking through a translator, said the government was working on ways to reduce the costs of livestock feed.
We are currently starting discussions regarding what we can do to control or to halt the accelerating price of feed input for poultry. We are encouraging to import feed from other commodities such as wheat, which is not a restricted access commodity. Soybean is also expensive, and this is a raw material that is problematic. And in the long term, we are encouraging the use of other sources of feed. And as we know, there are actually many alternatives for substituting these feed inputs.
Indonesia's Deputy Minister for Food and Agriculture, Ms. Dalifar Mahmud, speaking through a translator about their problem with high corn and cattle prices, ending that report from Dan Fitzgerald. So, if corn is currently too expensive for Indonesian feedlotters, what else could they feed their cattle and buffalo? Cheryl Kalish-Gordon is a senior grains and oilseed analyst with Rabobank. What do you reckon, Cheryl? Is this an opportunity for Australia?
Look, I think it is. And I think it is what happens when prices escalate. Operators and buyers will automatically look at what else could I source? What are the alternatives? What are the substitutes? Now, barley from Australia has, you know, it doesn't have a history of being in that category for use in Indonesia. Feed wheat certainly has. But with the, you know, the introduction of IACEPA, the Indonesian-Australian Comprehensive Economic Partnership Agreement last year, that introduced a tariff-free or a duty-free quota to allow the import of feed wheats and feed barley from Australia. So, look, this could line up really well with, you know, the logistics side, the tariff side of it being cleared a bit by IACEPA, plus the pricing making consumers question what they're using. It really could be. But we do need to remember that Indonesia has a long history of using corn in their feeding systems. So there's an education and there's a you know, a willingness to, or a need to be willing to transfer and operate a bit differently.
So Australia's sort of perfectly placed right now after the signing of that ICEPA agreement. And you had a bit to do with that, didn't you?
Yeah, look, getting that up and running has been a long time coming. So, you know, these things don't happen quickly. But one of the things that was really important in the development of that that agreement was really understanding that Australia and Indonesia are part of a supply chain, and working together to use our grains better in Indonesia is really good for both parties. So that IACEPA had an initiative to work together the Australian industry with the Indonesian side of the ledger to do that. And AGIC here in Australia, I know, has certainly been working on the backgrounding on how can Indonesian livestock feeders better use Australian grains. So, look, this over time could really work very much in our favour as consumers of livestock feed in Indonesia really get their heads around this alternative being barley from Australia and more of the feed wheat that they've already been using.
So with that in mind, in your opinion, is AGIC succeeding in trying to get into those markets?
Oh, look, there's been a lot of need for promotion of Australian grains in our international markets, probably none more than ever now because of what's been happening with our Chinese market access. Moving it along and making our buyers aware of the quality and availability of grain and how to best work with it to get the end products that you're after.
So just getting back to that global corn price. We've just heard that it's at its highest level since 2014, but the corn price affects other commodities. What influence is it having on some of the prices that we're getting for grains that we grow here in WA, Cheryl?
Yeah, look, the corn upswing to prices where, if you're looking in at CBOT pricing, it's trading with wheat, which is an unheard of type of phenomenon for corn to be trading with wheat. It's normally well below. Substitution possibility between feed wheat and corn, both in North and South America, where this corn price is really hitting hard in the feed sector, means that wheat prices are being pulled up. And so there's not a huge shortage of wheat globally, but it's being brought up by the maize price. So that's really good news for Australian wheat prices, particularly if Western Australia is planting as well at the moment and as successfully as I hear they are.
And it's time to crystal ball gaze now. I know analysts hate to do this, but which grain prices are set to shift the most in the next sort of 6 to 12 months, either up or down?
Look, I think it's a case of there's going to be a lot of volatility in the near term. So we could see still some great movement on any of the big three, whether that's soy, corn or wheat, simply because we're in a northern hemisphere weather market. So tight is the supply prospects out of, say, Brazil on the corn front, that any little weather adverse events in the US, sometimes we get a snowstorm at this time of the year, sometimes we'll get hot periods later when the corn is finishing. Those things will actually move the market much more than we normally see. So be prepared for some volatility on those markets. With wheat, we're thinking that it's going to settle a bit as we go forward now, but stay above that 700 cents on the US CBOT equivalent over the next 12 months. So that's about 40% above the five-year average. So a good support for Australian prices from that global perspective.
And Cheryl, what's going on with canola at the moment? The price has just jumped to record highs, and then in the last week it's really come back a bit. Are we anticipating that they're going to drop significantly from here?
Look, there can be, you would imagine there would be some softening from these historically high pricing. What's been happening is that the market has really been calling for planting and calling for supply. That's been a little bit satisfied in some areas of the world by the securing of supplies in this very tight edible oils market. So, you know, it's not just the canola market. It is the soybean market, and it is all other edible oils too. So we're looking at a tight market on this out to 2022. And, you know, it's the fact that Europe in particular has really come in, or is looking to come in, with its third successive year of low production, but also some really strong demand from some initiatives that are coming out of North America and some states, California primarily, that is looking for what they're calling renewable biodiesel, which is low intensity carbon biodiesel, which canola really stacks up well as a feedstock in. So some extra demand, less supply, setting it up for a good short term and some support structurally in the midterm.
And just finally this afternoon, should our grain farmers be worried about China putting a freeze on the importation of other grains grown in Australia, do you think?
Look, I think that such is the uncertainty in global markets at the moment. We should always be willing to look for alternative buyers, always hedging where we're looking at end markets. We are in a situation where the world needs grain, China needs grain, so it would be a really interesting move by China to stop importing other grains from Australia, but I wouldn't discount it.
So it remains to be seen at this stage?
Remains to be seen.
Cheryl, thank you so much for joining us on the WA Country Hour this afternoon. It's Cheryl Kalish-Gordon, and she's a Senior Grains and Oilseed Analyst with Rabobank. It is 7 minutes to one.
On ABC Radio WA, this is the WA Country Hour.
Hello, I'm Sally Sara. Join me for The World Today. Pressure's growing to allow international students back into Australia. The cash-strapped higher education sector needs the billions of dollars they bring, but can the already strained quarantine system cope? And Telstra's massive fine for ripping off Indigenous customers. Financial counsellors say the problem is much wider than just the telco giant. Join us for those stories and more from across the country and around the globe on The World Today.
And Mount Barker held a cattle sale today. Only 490 head yarded today. So numbers down 300 on last week. Tracy Kilner was there. Tracy, can you run through the prices, please?
With the limited number of cattle on offer, all categories are up, with quality the only limiting factor. Feeder buyers were chasing the better steers, pushing prices up to 596 cents a kilo for medium weight Angus steers. The wiener steers weighing over 330 kilos sold for 560 cents, up 35 cents, while medium weights gained 20 cents, selling for 532 to 596 cents, and lightweights eased on quality, returning 530 to 536 cents a kilo. Wiener heifers weighing over 330 kilos made 516 cents, while medium weights sold for 494 to 514 cents, and lightweights returned 456 to 480 cents a kilo. Yearling steers gained, selling for 396 to 552 cents. Yearling heifers were up as well, returning 380 to 428 cents a kilo. Grown steers weighing over 600 kilos made 345 to 376 cents. 400 to 500 kilo grown steers sold for 418 to 428 cents a kilo. Grown heifers weighing over 540 kilos made 294 to 338 cents. And the lighter weights sold from 324 up to 466 cents. Heavy prime cows sold for 290 to 326 cents. Medium weights made 304 to 316 cents a kilo. And store cows were mixed in quality, selling from 100 cents up to 374 cents for the young cows. Heavy bulls eased 20 cents, selling for 286 to 334 cents. And a pen of lightweight bullies made 396 cents a kilo. This has been Tracy Kilner for Meat and Livestock Australia's National Livestock Reporting Service.
Thank you for that update, Tracy. Now, it's almost time for you to head off to the news, but before you do, if you're a sheep producer, you've no doubt come across plenty of triplet lambs, probably even quads. But how about six lambs? That was the remarkable scene that greeted Willowra North farmer Jack Tucker when he was checking his lambing ewes on Sunday. Rural reporter Angus Verley spoke with him about the once-in-a-lifetime event.
Yes, I was doing our usual lambing run on Sunday, Mother's Day, coincidentally, and all was going to plan, and yeah, I came across this ewe with six lambs, which is nothing unusual in that I just thought it was a ewe with some other lambs following it around, which is quite commonplace with all breeds. But then I continued to watch her, and her behaviour was definitely different, and she was butting other ewes away, and then she led them off into the corner and proceeded to attempt to feed all six of them, which really opened my eyes and it made me realise, I think, that we got six lambs on our hands.
How did she manage that job of trying to feed them all?
Yeah, it was a bit of a circus. She was sort of pushing them in under and they're all fighting each other like little kids, pushing each other out of the way. I must say six is too many. It was probably never going to be a great outcome. There's only two teats on a ewe, but she certainly gave it her best effort. They were all looking fit and healthy. And following her all around the paddock.
And pretty amazing, isn't it? Because multiples are common, triplets fairly common, quads maybe you come across from time to time, and quintuplets I have heard of before, but sextuplets, well, that's really something else, isn't it?
Oh, definitely, Angus. Yeah, we get, as all breeds do, twins are commonplace, triplets are not unusual. We've very rarely had quads, never seen five, and six is just out of the question, and probably the surprise was that they're all alive and healthy too. The first thing you would think of with six lambs is that there'd be serious issues and that they mightn't be all up and about. But as you can see in that picture, they're all quite healthy.
Yeah, so they all survived the birthing process. And how are they travelling now?
Yeah, it was never going to be achievable for you to raise six lambs. So I think it was about 3 days after. I couldn't intervene because she's in a paddock with a whole lot of other ewes and lambs and it would have just disturbed the rest of the mob too much. But on the third day, one was missing. No sign of it, dead or alive, but it was gone. And there was a couple that were noticeably starting to fall behind, so I did manage to grab them. And they're actually on a bottle now. They've moved to town with my cousin, so they're living a life of luxury.
Okay, and so the ewe's got three left with her now.
She has, and I know which ewe she is, but there's probably three or four sets of triplets in that same paddock, so she's probably not feeling that special, although she's doing it easy, having three after six, I'd imagine.
And, Jack, we put a picture up on the ABC Landline Facebook page, and really a pretty huge reaction to it, wasn't there?
Yeah, there was, Angus. I initially put it on there as a comment after I saw a picture of quads, some merino quads on the same page, and I thought I'd better fly the flag for the Dorper breed, so I put this picture of six up, and Landline contacted me and put it up. Yeah, and it's amazing. Everyone likes little lambs with black heads.
That was Willowra North farmer Jack Tucker speaking with Angus Verley. Poor mum. And a few texts coming in this afternoon. Hi, Rob here. Seating away at Canna, and I can assure you we've had no rain here last night. Rain last week between 6 and 16 mils across our farms. We're seeding now and we'd love it if you could organise some moisture to get out into our soils. We'll do our best, Rob. And on that legislation to ban companies making plant-based products from using the word meat, Jason says these companies have spent millions of dollars in research to make plants taste like meat. Now they need to confuse the consumer into buying it to make it worth their while. It's disgusting. I have no issues with them putting this stuff out, but they need to market it correctly so it becomes theirs and not stealing from meat farmers who are struggling as it is. Well, that's a wrap for today's show. It's always fantastic to have you along on the WA Country Hour. News time now, 1 o'clock.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.